Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the businesses of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And we are delighted today to have with us, from a new challenger, Sean Alexander Allen. Sean, how are you?
I'm doing good despite, you know, everything.
Pandemic good.
Pandemic good, which is really just great. It's like grading on a curve.
Yeah, it is kind of like grading on a curve. Pandemic good is the rest of the time somewhat terrible.
It is.
Yeah.
But we're happy because we have you with us today.
It's true. And we haven't hung out in forever.
Yeah, like we usually see you all the time.
At least five times a year.
And and we have not seen you in a while. And it has broken our hearts.
Very sad.
But I remember PAX East last year specifically, like when we got off the train.
Yeah.
The first two people that I saw.
It was perfect.
In Boston.
Yeah. We were hanging out outside the CVS because, all right, TMI time for our listeners. I have a CPAP machine, and therefore, whenever we go somewhere, I need to get myself some distilled water if I can, or else I'm dry as heck for the week.
Yeah.
And that's no fun. Maybe I won't have to use that thing for much longer. We'll see.
Gonna get swole.
Get swole. So, Sean, you just released a new game, and we will talk about Treachery and Beatdown City in a little bit. Very excited about that. But we want to start, as we do most, if not all, of our interviews, with your origin story. Tell us how you got into the industry.
Yeah, it's kind of a roundabout way. I feel like, I don't know, I always wanted to be a part of something of some industry. I think it's funny, like games always, like I got Nintendo Powers instead of Nintendo games as a kid, because like my mom could afford like barely afford $12 a year for Nintendo Power, not which meant she couldn't like afford a console, and I would play games at friends' houses. And so I mostly drew, and I wanted to be a comic book artist for a while, but I don't know, there was something always itching at me where every time I would make a comic thing, I was always like, ah, maybe this should be like a video game. But then again, like I went to school and I started school, went to school visual arts for graphic design. Again, like I didn't know what I wanted to do really. And because in New York, we didn't have game stuff at all. And I actually later found out that like when I transferred to computer art, which is basically just character animation. They don't teach you anything else. They were just like,
weird.
This is how you make characters, and this is how you like model them. They're not really going to teach you environmental modeling or anything. Like, it was really bizarre. Like,
that's strange.
Yeah, and I even had a teacher, my modeling teacher, taught us the bad version of modeling, because there's NURBS and then there's polygons. Mm-hmm. And as we've all heard, there's polygons, right? Like NURBS is for like architectural modeling, which is very mathematical, where if you accidentally delete a point here, you might destroy the entire mathematical equation that makes up your thing, so you'll destroy it. And it's mostly for like hard surface modeling, versus like I always say, it's like polygon modeling is like modeling from clay, just fun and nice, and modeling with NURBS is like trying to take like a sledgehammer to a giant piece of marble that might just completely fall apart if you hit it in the wrong place.
I feel like this is actually an idea for a game.
I think I played that VR game. like, yeah, so I mean, you know, I actually, the way I talked myself into computer art, it was funny. It was being jerks about trying to get into computer art, and I really just had this zeal. Like I don't know what was going on with me at the time, but I thought Doom 3 was like the coolest looking thing at the time, which I don't know why, but
I mean, it was Doom.
It's true.
But I mean, I don't know, like Doom 64 is my Doom. Like Doom 3 looked interesting. I thought it was like 3D wise, but it was also like that grim dark that I'm not really into as a person. Like all my art was like comic book characters and anime sword fighters and stuff like that. Like that's so what cool. I really wanted to make if I wanted to make a video game. So I don't know why Doom 3 thought that would be like the best way. You know, that's like, oh, 3D, right? It's the top of 3D in video games, I guess. So parallel to all this, I was working at EB Games. And also, like right when I started school and everything had a bad breakout with my girlfriend, and all my friends basically moved away. So like my best friends all went to like Rochester and Albany and Florida. So, and then I went to Brooklyn Tech. I had a lot of friends, and they all just moved to schools everywhere else. And so I was basically left to having, the internet basically be like where I would meet people. So it was hopped on IGN and became a moderator there, back in 2000. And it helped me with a lot of the depression about all my friends leaving, and just I got to make friends and also meet like IGN press people through AIM chat rooms.
That's so nice.
I know like Per Schneider from like 2000, right? Like I know Fran Mirabella since 2000. He was like IGN GameCube. So it was funny because like then,
Fran's cool.
Then since I was in EB Games, I ended up I started EB Games 2002, and back then you could get an E3 pass as a retail employee, bottom rung. So on my $9,000 a year, I was like, I should go to E3. slept on someone's like floor and could barely afford any I avoid the Denny's during E3 because that just reminds me of the time I could not afford to get a refill of chocolate milk. I was freaking out. I had to penny pinch just to get out there. But that was my first E3. So that was so that's one of my friends always says, you've been hustling at this since like 2003. Like you went to your first big industry event. You were just in retail. And so I would do like focus tests at Rockstar. They would come by the EB Games that I would just hang out with that I ended up getting a job at. So I got to play like Smuggler's Run 3, GTA 3, State of Emergency, and like they would give us like pizza and stuff. Like all of these things kind of, I think, were very alluring to me. And it was interesting because that E3 was like super classist, though, because you got to really understand that if you did not work for like, if you were not important in the industry, you were not important to anybody.
Yep.
So like even like IGN people who had I had talked to on like forums and stuff, and I was like, oh, I'm coming out there, really had, you know, maybe less to talk to you about, like because they're very busy. And it's like, you know, I know lots of press people now who are really busy who still at least say hi and give me a conversation. So it was kind of like...
it's true. I even give free hugs.
Well, exactly. I mean, at least before the pandemic.
Yeah. I'll still hug Sean.
That's fair.
Yeah, we just got to get a test first.
It's fine. We'll both wear masks.
Yeah.
We'll do a temperature check and we'll wear masks.
Just wrap me in saran wrap so I can hug Sean.
So this kind of all comes back down to, like, I was graduating school. I saw a PR job at Rockstar. I applied for that. I got two interviews, and then it went nowhere because of internal strife, apparently. Then politics. I was really bummed that summer, and I finally got a game capture job opened up. And that was my job for the next 4 years. Basically, because of, like, computer art stuff that I was working on, because 3D movies, right? I was like really into, but because I'm very into like 2D, actually, I was really into storyboarding, and I think that actually they really liked my camera usage, which was not a thing that they taught you at SVA. They didn't teach you cameras unless you went into fine classes. Like they would teach you cameras in like the film department, but not, or they'd teach you storyboarding in the film department, the comic book department, not in the computer art department. So you'd see like, you know, lots of theses that just have cameras that fly all over the place, and they would criticize you for not knowing these things but wouldn't teach you any of it. So thankfully I kind of, because I was really into comics, I think that really, like, you know, comics are all about like the camera has to tell the whole story without any movement. So it helped me with my storyboards, and then that helped me with making like kind of a striking thesis at basically being able to just talk about camera work and just knowing a lot about games, and it was what got me in the door.
That's awesome. That's a very cool path.
I mean, almost everyone that we've talked to, even our paths into the game, into the game industry, have been topsy-turvy, completely bananas. So it's kind of, I feel like it's this normal thing to just fall into video games.
Yeah. I mean, You kind of stumble in there, and you know, some people stay forever.
Yeah.
Some people claw their way out.
Yeah. Claw their way out. Oh boy.
Hey, Sean, how long were you at Rockstar?
1.5 years. I did game capture for 4 years, and I really wanted to, like, I don't know, I got, like, the trailer making process is very repetitious because it's like, get new game, everyone's psyched to put out trailer for new game, but new game obviously doesn't run or look like it will when it comes out. So you're making a trailer at where you take 3 steps in a direction and you fall off the world, or there's just like all these things that, you know, a game that's 3 years off from coming out is prone to do, obviously. So you're trying, I mean, the great thing is that they make all their games, their all their trailers in game. Like, so when you see a trailer from Rockstar, it's a game trailer, and that the things that are in there are things that we had to do. Mm-hmm. They're spliffs with like cutscenes or whatever. But so then, yeah, 4-ish years in, I was just kind of like, GTA 5's first trailer was the last one I worked on, and I was just like, there's so much pressure here, and I just didn't want to do it again. Like, I had done the first Red Dead trailer, that was like the big, like, unknown, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and I worked on LA Noire's first big trailer, and like, you know, working on early trailers for games where people are super nervous if they come out just mean there's like, it's just a lot. Like, there's a lot of notes, there's a lot of repetition, and I just don't want to do it anymore. And so I really started pushing to move more towards the dev environment, and I got stuck in a strange position in QA, which I learned a lot about, like, QA in a very short amount of time. But like, I knew that as a big company, like, I was like kind of put in a position where if I wanted to be a producer, I'd have to be there for like 10 more years. Oof. And I just didn't want to do that. And then there was like a confluence that kind of came up in 2012 where, being able to leave and work on my own thing. Like, I also caught the indie bug, like, where I really wanted to, like, I saw all these cool games that were coming out, and I got to get my first E3 back in as an industry professional, like Rockstar. Everyone obviously wanted to talk to me, but someone that a friend of one of my old coworkers introduced me to this guy, and I got to go to a party with like people who like Nathan Vella, who was the head of Capybara Games, not Cappy, it was still Capybara Games at the time. So they had just put out Might and Magic, like, dual screens or whatever, for DS, which I actually really liked, but, you know, they were not Super Brothers Sword and Sorcery yet, right? Like, it wasn't like,
right.
It was right before a lot of this stuff got big. So I met a lot of indie devs who were doing it, and that made me like really like, I want to make a game. So that, like, you know, that last 6 months or so, like, I realized I wasn't going to get to do what I wanted, and we kind of had like a mutual breakup.
So you decided to shift. Like, you made the shift from this job at Rockstar. You were successful, even if it was repetitive. It was, it seems like it was a relatively stable job. You were good at what you did, and you decided I'm gonna say this from the outside, having seen those trailers. At what you do, man.
Yeah, that LA Noire trailer. That game is so special to me. And I absolutely, like, thinking back to it now, it brings back such happy memories. I'm like, oh my God, I was so hype about this game.
There was actually a funny thing where, just remember, I said to another, like, someone high up, this is an adventure game, not an action game, right? This is like Quest Pro presents Spider-Man on Apple II. Like, I'm all about adventure games. And they were like, get it. A lot of people don't get it. And so, you know, we really focused on, yeah, like, you know, we had to sell the, like, sizzle of the action, but we really tried to focus a lot on the VO and the face tech.
Yeah. And all that stuff. Well, and that's what got me so excited about the game coming out, is that it was finally a Rockstar game that I could see myself playing all the way through, where I wouldn't just get annoyed with it partway through because I don't like playing as the bad guy. Like, at all. Mm-hmm. I'm so bad at being the bad guy.
I remember reading about LA Noire Informer and, like, just being so enamored of the facial tech and everything.
So cool. And, it's such a sad story, but it's so cool.
It is. That is a story for another time about that game. So you were doing this work at Rockstar. You decided that you want to get more into development. What year was this that you decided that you made the call to go in?
I mean, again, it was like like a snowball effect into it, but it was 2012.
Okay.
It was like middle of 2012 when I left.
And when you left, what was it that you were thinking? Like, what did you have a plan in place, or were you kind of moving back into an experimental position, or what were you thinking?
Well, like the thing about me is I've never really been in a position where being unemployed is a good thing. Like I know I have like a friend who's like, I'm leaving my job and I'm going to be doing something in a couple of months. And I'm like, man, I've never had like 2 months where I wasn't like thinking about not eating or something, you know, like,
totally.
So for me, basically, you know, I kind of had this game idea. I had a lot of ideas in the back of my head, and I was trying to see, like, it was basically like that day I was like, I'd kind of heard through the grapevine that there was this PlayStation Mobile managed partner type thing, managed developer type thing that could maybe have some money. And that, like, I'd gotten a call about that actually my last day at Rockstar. So it was interesting. Like, I basically was like, oh, well, I have, like, you know, severance money and stuff that I could start working on a thing to help me with that. Yeah. So it was like very much like, okay, well, hopefully this will pan out. That was it was actually me going out on a limb being like, I'm not going to go, because the thing is, the games industry doesn't really exist in New York so much, like in terms of like a company that will hire you. Yep. Avalanche had just come here, and I had talked to people, said you should apply. At that point, I was just kind of like, I just don't want to get into that mood right now. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of got like some just good news that like said like, hey, if you can send this pitch budget, like we could do something with it. So that had me in the like first week of my time. Like, I basically just took some time, finished I think Mass Effect 2 something, and then although like the first 3 months, that severance just vanished faster than I thought it would.
Always does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you know, like, let's build on the whole New York City development scene, because, you know, I went and I did some pretty intensive digging into the indie scene, especially in New York, just before I left my job as editor-in-chief at Game Daily. And I want to, like, from your perspective, you know, we can talk about how AAA has changed, and we can talk about how the indie scene has changed, but let's in general talk about how things have changed and grown since you began, you know, to dive into indie development.
I mean, it was also the other thing that I was thinking about in 2012 was going to school, going back to school, specifically the NYU Game Center.
Oh, yeah.
They were starting their master's program, because they were, before that, they were just kind of a loose collective of, like, classes that you could take at NYU. And I think, like, Frank Lance was really pushing to, like, you know, get an actual degree program in. And I got in, work on getting paid, like, not a lot of money, but something to work on a video game with PlayStation Mobile, and having to owe tens of thousands on top of my already, like, student loan debt. Mm-hmm. I was just like, I told Frank, I was like, I can't do this. He's like, you know, I respect that, because I think NYU also at the time, like, it was, I don't know, I think getting money out of that school was like trying to get blood from a stone, especially from a brand new program. And the thing that was stupid is, I'm like, look, I have like tons of experience in this industry, like more than anyone else who's in the coming into the department, and I'm also a minority. Like, you should be going out of your way to get me to be in this, like, because I probably teach something if not going there. But yeah, like, so the NYU Game Center around that time was very dear to me, where it was just like, I don't know, there was, it was just kind of a place where you could meet a lot of great people. A lot of the people that I met there, like, I actually made a small independent game, the Global Game Jam of 2012. That was kind of how I got my taste that I could project manage, sort of, and design make a thing.
That's awesome.
And, like, Evan Narciss wrote about it, like, and I didn't know him. Like, this was before I knew a lot of people. My first GDC was that year also, so that's where I met Evan. I saw him in the hall, and I was like, oh, man. Wrote about The Universe Within. Thank you. He was like, yeah, like, Frank really was digging it, so I really wanted to check it out. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, the fact that I had, like, a weird article on Kotaku, like, about this small little indie game made in 48 hours with, like, an amazing team of people that, like, some of them I'm still in good contact with. I still work with a few of them.
That's rad.
And so, yeah, so that year was, yeah, that year, I mean, that year in a lot of ways was just, like, my kind of awakening to even, like, political stuff and whatever. I was kind of, like, and just how, like, looking at how the industry exists, like, mm-hmm. looking at how few Black people there were in mm-hmm. a company. Like, you know, Rockstar Games is a company that is, they talk about how they wanted to be, like, the Def Jam of games. I'm like, the Def Jam of games? Def Jam was run by a Black person, right? Yeah. Like, and, like, it started by, like, a conglomerate of minds, and, you know, like, Rick Rubin, I got forced out, as far as I know, but, like, you know, still, like, he was fine when he left doing American Records with Slayer and everything, and they had, you know, LL Cool J, they had all this amazing talent, but it was, like, you know, Rockstar wasn't, like, it was a company that trafficked in Black talent and culture,
yeah.
But I was one of six people in the company, and none of us had, like, you know, power, we had no, like, decision-making, and so, yeah, Avalanche was coming in. I wasn't completely sure about that. AAA, I didn't want to do. I'd kind of seen a lot of stuff come and go. Like, I applied to Gameloft, a lot of positions mm-hmm. that all kind of dried up before, like, I had graduated. Yeah. Loft is a company that kind of comes and goes as they please, I guess. Like, they it lay does. Off everyone, bring a lot of people on. I think, you know, over this time, few years, like, you know, King came in, bought a bunch of stuff, and then laid everyone off.
Yep.
Which, if they had not bought a bunch of stuff, maybe they wouldn't have had to lay off and close all the studios. Like, they mm-hmm. just left well enough alone.
Well, and we were, that was, if we look at 2012 in particular, we were in the middle of that big cycle where you had mega publishers coming in, buying studios, and then shutting them down, what, 3 years later?
Yeah, absolutely. So, that became one of the most prevalent trends of the last generation of consoles, yeah. especially.
And it was Activision did it, EA did it, Microsoft did it.
Yep.
So, I mean, this Microsoft was
some, I would say Microsoft and EA, between the two of them, they were the worst in absolutely. That generation.
And of not course, in
New
yeah.
York, though.
No, not in New in, York, yeah. But generally no, in the industry. No, just across
the industry.
Oh, yeah. But the thing that's different is that at least you could go somewhere else and get a job.
Mm-hmm.
True.
In elsewhere,
yeah, like in Los Angeles,
in New York, and you when like Chaos Studios folded, that just sent people running, right? Yeah. Like, they had to go. Where are they going to go? Somewhere else.
I mean, they could go upstate to Vicarious Visions, you know, but there wasn't. There's not a lot in the city.
No,
like yeah, going upstate is like going to a different country.
Yep.
Like going from New York City, like the center of like a lot of cultural things, mm-hmm. and being like, oh. I want to not be anywhere near that. Yeah. It's like,
I mean, the Albany area is nice. Like Troy's okay.
Albany's fine.
Yeah, but it's not New York.
I'm just saying, like, but it's not New York. York
yeah,
yeah. It's
and it's like, so you might as well. That's why when you say you're from New York, you mean New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say I'm from New York State or Long Island or something. Like, there's always a caveat there because New York City is where our graffiti and hip hop comes from, right? You come mm-hmm. from. It's where fine artists come from. It's where punk. It was huge. Like, it's like that's where like art kind of comes from, like, and there's big art scenes like around the city now especially, but a lot of that comes from city people who move up. Like, you know, my mom didn't move to New York state, she moved to New York City. My dad moved to New York City, like, he was a rocker. My mom was a poet. Like, you couldn't have done that in Albany, New York. It wasn't.
No, definitely not.
Oh,
that's like, a distinctly New York thing from what I've come to learn from being an outsider.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, we had a lot of indie stuff, too. Like, we had Sports Friends, which was huge. That's like mm-hmm. a Barra Ball. That was actually a big thing because that was on Kickstarter with Barra Ball, Super Pole Riders,
mm-hmm.
you know, the first version that people could play of Johann Sebastian Joust.
Oh, man.
Side of, like, hanging out with Doug and Hokra. Like, so it was, like, kind of this epic, like, mega band of games coming together to do this big Kickstarter push. You know, I've seen it, you know, Kickstarter's here, so they've been very helpful for a lot of mm-hmm. local projects. And so, but like, also, like, while I was working, I kind of had to put my head down. I kind of lost the plot about a lot of stuff. There's also like a lot of like opportunistic stuff coming up where like people want, like, they started like doing like pitch nights and demo nights, and I kind of started to lose the plot of those two because it wasn't like, what was the point of pitching your thing to an audience of people who couldn't give you money?
Sure.
And, yeah. You know, we've got Games for Change that wants to just co-opt all of the, like, they want to co-opt the cool games that, like, say something to try to, and, like, lump them in with games that have 10 paragraphs of text to tell you that, like, there's a bad thing happening in a country somewhere that aren't just, you know, like, because, like, edutainment and, like, serious games are often, like, not made very well. And even people who make them often because of like budgets and like constraints and things that you need to do. So Games for Change has, you know, struggled to find their voice. I once got in a Twitter battle with their CEO because he like kind of bragged about making a six-figure salary. And then he ended up leaving the company he was in the company. They let go of like lots of people that I said, Games for Change doesn't care about you. And they didn't care about them because they let them all go and they kept their six-figure CEO. And then you got all these groups. There used to be this New York Games meetup that kind of started trying to start being like a business, basically. Mm-hmm. Now, ended up turning into this thing called Playcrafting.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But like Playcrafting, like me and friends have been a part of, and there was a Gamergate person who was actively a part of the community. Oh. And my friend Kat, when she was starting the Game Devs of Color Expo, so this is another side, is we were talking a lot about like, hey, there's no space really for black and brown people, even in like the New York game scene, like what can we do? So she started to work on the first Game Devs of Color Expo. And when they announced it, like this guy goes off and starts shouting about how he says that they're race baiting devs.
Oh my who've God.
Never done anything worthwhile in the industry, and going after them over Twitter. I'm like, Kat used to be a part of, so Codelaboration was a thing. So we've had like women teaching women how to code. Like that's like a thing that we did a lot in New York also that was coming up. And I'm like, Kat was a founding member of that. Like, I'm like, what do you mean? She's never done anything. Like besides making her own games, she's also helped people make their own games as well. So like, and then that guy, when I brought up that this guy was like kind of, and other people told me this guy was like a stalker, and I told head of Playcrafting like, you need to drop this dude from your thing, he was resistant to it.
Oof.
And even featured his game at like Play NYC, which was their first big event that they claimed was the first games event in New York, despite the fact that we have IndieCade, we have NYU's events, we have the Game Devs of Color Expo, which was literally that same summer. And so they put out a press release claiming to be the first games focused event, and then they were featuring this dude's game at the forefront, and I like was like, I'm done. Like, I had taught things for them. I had done a lot of stuff. I had helped try to make the community better, gave a lot of advice. And so it's like, you know, we get these groups that just actively seem like they're trying to create, like, because it kind of, like, started making the ad hoc classes smaller and smaller and trying to focus more on, like, these expensive Unity dev things. So you're spending, like, thousands of dollars to learn Unity. But, you know, that may or may not get you anywhere. Knowing Unity is not going to change your life 100% like tomorrow, right? Mm-hmm. Like you still need to find funds, and it might be 5 years off before you earn a penny on your investment in this class. So now we have the, you know, we also, firstly, we have the Game Devs of Color Expo, which like people come all the way up to Harlem from all over the world and say that that event like reinvigorates them, and that they usually feel tired after events, and this one like they feel inspired and happy and want to do something.
I love GDoc. It was amazing. I went to my very first GDoc last year, and I was so like floored that they would, you know, let me come and cover the event, especially as a business journalist. But oh my goodness, yes, I felt so inspired and so like it was just, the energy was electric and all of these games were amazing, and I could have just stayed in that space, possibly moved in.
I mean, I barely get to be on the floor, and I always get like teary a little bit just looking around and seeing how like excited people are, and just even just like the makeup of the audience and people showing off their games. But I mean, obviously you're welcome. Everyone is welcome at our event. We make our event very inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is the opposite of when you harbor people who are kind of hate mongers. So it's like, those are things that like, I don't agree with, but I also don't have the energy to chase an event. Like, I just tell mostly POCs in the dev scene in New York, I'm like, don't go to these things because they're not out. Also, if you pay attention to their business model, not out there for you. They're out there for them. We are not a company. Game Devs of Color Expo is not a company. We do not pay like a salary to anybody. We pay everyone something, but like, it's not like we're trying to keep ourselves alive for the sake of keeping ourselves alive, which is a lot of what happens in the games industry. Is there's these groups that say they're for game developers or whoever, but they're mostly there to exist, like to get money to keep themselves alive. And that's something I've learned over the last, you know, 8 years or so.
It's a big problem in institutionalized nonprofit organizations, and you have this giant divide between grassroots organizations like GDOC, which doesn't have, do you guys have a formalized structure at all, or is it an event that is kind of, it comes together and then the structure around it dissipates until the next time?
We have six organizers. We because of just people's workloads in life, we had to basically start, the key thing is we just had to delineate between organizer, which means you're doing a lot of work, and contributor, which means you're doing more focused work in smaller, you're not like expect, like, you know, for me, like I get on calls with sponsors, I curate all the speakers, I meet with all the speakers day of, look at all their talks, I go through all their questions and I say, I like this, I don't like that. So I'm sitting there with all this. And then I sit there, I go through games, I recommend, I write copy, right? Like, so like, you know, I do all these different things and then I go out and I promote the hell out of the event, like at other events, like going to PAX or whatever. And I try to solicit sponsors. That's what an organizer does. Like a contributor comes and beats for us. They're still very important, but like, they're not given like a ton of stuff because, you know, we'd feel bad. Like we try to pay people like proportionately and like we don't have a ton of money. So it's like, you know, if you could just be around and tweet for us and do some social media here and there, or if you can run our volunteers for the day and just make sure that they're ready for that day, that's great. And those people are like really like invaluable in doing that one thing, because that's a thing I can't do, right? I can't, like, we only have six people that are our organizers right now. So, and we're all, you know, people with day jobs who may or may not be working to get a game out right now. So, like for the last several years also, like, and so it's like, that's kind of how we had to figure it out, because, you know, if someone stopped working, someone stopped doing the five things that they said they would and just dropped them, then they'd all fall on everyone else. And we'd have to be like, look, bud, you got to go to like, if you want to do a thing, that's cool. If you don't want to do anything, that's fine. But we're not going to have you on stage as like, you're the organizer of this event, because that's not fair. And that was like the key thing. You know, it's really hard when you are a small group and you, and someone drops like several balls just because, you know, their life, right? It's life. We understand 100%. It's hard, but just it's, we always try to give someone, be like, hey, if you don't want to do this anymore, it's okay to step out. Just don't try to take credit for putting on the event. That's the only thing.
That makes good sense. Well, I mean, you're talking about, you know, being in the midst of launching a game, potentially, may or may not, but you actually have recently launched a game, and I want everybody to know about Treachery and Beatdown City. So walk us through some of the development process, you know, some challenging moments, some big successes, you know, a treasured story from the floor of the developments.
It's interesting because like the IMS development has been on and off for, you know, a long time, like longer than when, like 2012 was when we were like, okay, we're going to make this game. But, you know, before that it was, you know, kind of an idea. It was like wouldn't this be cool? Like it's this game, Treachery Beatdown City, is like a pared down version of a bigger game concept that I'd come up with, which like I was stupid. I was like, a few of us could get together and make a game that looks like Street Fighter 4. Of course. And then, so then I basically actually started like just making pixel art. Like that was just like my thing, was like how I designed a lot of characters that were supposed to be Street Fighter characters that were supposed to look like Street Fighter 4, like high poly, whatever, nice, just like illustrations. And then I was like, you know what, I need to translate this into something that I think I'll be able to use. And then I started like looking for a style, I still didn't know if it was going to become a thing. Then again, then that's when I left Rockstar in 2012, and then I was like, okay, this is going to be a thing, so we really need to, like, I dumped all my severance and my, I, New York State or City, I don't know, has a self-employment assistance program.
Oh.
Where, like, it's a really strange name thing, because it's basically they let you, unemployment is, again, a double-edged thing where it's like they give you some money, it's not a lot of money, and then you're told that you have to actively look for work. If you do a second of work, like,
yep,
like if you say, I thought about starting a business that is working, mm-hmm. and you are now no longer able to be unemployment. And I'm like, it's just wild. Like, you think about working on your own thing. It's like this thing that actively disincentivizes people to start their own businesses or come up with new things. Or, you know, if you just said, hey, here's your unemployment, go work on whatever the hell you want, we'll support you for a bit. And that's what the self-employment assistance program is that you can then work on your own business while on unemployment. And they make you take some classes. All the classes were grifts to get you to basically buy services from all the teachers. Like, they were like, here's how to do a business plan. But if you really want to know, I do them. That's my business, is I work on business plans for people. And I'm like, well, you probably charge more than my unemployment for a few months, and I need that for rent and, like, paying bills and stuff. So, you know, I went to those. I learned some stuff, and so I just worked on the game in the meantime, and that was, so then PlayStation Mobile, literally, like, my severance, I had to cash out my 401k, which was tiny, because I didn't have enough money to put into that, because I didn't get paid a whole lot when AAA, and, went towards like my LLC, because they're really expensive here.
Yeah,
and
we just formed one in New Jersey, and
it was pretty expensive here too.
Did you do the newspaper thing? You have to put in like a announcement of your LLC in two different newspapers.
What? No,
which you have to do in New York. Yeah,
that is not a requirement in New Jersey.
It's where the expense comes from, because, like, it literally, you have to pay to basically place an ad in two newspapers. Which is also a grift, because it's like you're giving a newspaper money for no reason whatsoever. Because it's not like, will someone come after you? It's just you have to place, like, a small thing, and you really have to watch your words, right? Because it's just, it's more and more if you put another word. Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah.
So, wow, I had no idea that was a requirement. I mean, it's not in New Jersey, because I definitely read everything. I did not see a pay a newspaper money requirement.
Because
print is dead, let's be real. No, I'm just...
That's the thing. I think that's literally why that exists as a caveat, is to just make sure that newspapers get their paper on top of everything. They're like, you know what? We're just going to have a... You know, it's like side channels of money, right? They're like, we're going to get it from people trying to start their own business.
It's kind of shady.
Yeah, let's bleed people dry as they're trying to bootstrap.
Cool beans. Again, you needed an LLC to work with Sony.
Yep.
So I got that, and basically all that money ran out right as I got the first, like, bit of money from PlayStation Mobile. And, you know, the reason why I talk about, like, double-edged sword is we'd been working in Game Maker, putting together a demo, and we showed it off at, like, an IndieCade, and they were like, yeah, just get this on, like, PlayStation Mobile, and, like, we'll be golden. Like, that's great. Like, we basically made something that we were like, this is the fighting system we want to make. And it was fun, and it was functional, and we were like, yeah, this is good, this is working well. It was a lot of help from other developers giving us tips. Shout outs to my friend Barut Pfeiffer, who's a programmer in the industry, who did all the programming for a lot of the programming for Skulls of the Shogun game that came out a long time ago. Met him at that, like, E3 party all those years ago, back when Skulls of the Shogun had no name. So it's like, you know, again, like, it's like these things that have stayed with my life, like Barut having just a lot of experience with, like, creating combat and stuff. He gave us, like, the tools that we needed to get enemies kind of coming in and out of you fighting them. But, like, PlayStation Mobile ran on this SDK that was terrible. Like, it was like and so it's like, it's literally how we got to keep making the game, was because we were given not enough money to really live, but, like, you know, across two people and having to go to events and stuff. But, you know, it was, you know, we're both used to being, me and Nico, the programmer, we grew up very poor, so we were able to live very meagerly. And, but yeah, it was like, so it was like, literally we were trying to fight to get the game to exist. while having this giving us the platform to show it at events. So here's a good example. One day we had to update our SDK. There was this whole thing where we just had to keep updating the SDK. It's pretty wild. You had to keep always checking online to make sure that the game could run, like, which actually made a big problem at E3 one year, where E3 had no Wi-Fi, but the games all needed to check that SDK was the correct thing. So someone had to use like a hotspot in order to get the games like recertified for the next few hours. The good example is one day we had to update our SDK. We didn't touch anything in the game. The game was just a black screen.
Oh no.
We didn't know why. And that like took over a month to fix. And it was like literally a month of like being like, I don't have a whole lot of money. Like, what the hell is going on? We can't go forward until we fix this. And it was actually like an issue, like the SDK accepted improper syntax for like upper or lowercase, but now it didn't. So now, like, if it was had to be uppercase always or lowercase always, that was like one little change. Because it was kind of immature and it was being put together. It was like bizarro Unity, basically. Like, if you opened up Unity side by side, it looked kind of similar, but everything was opposite. Like, it takes in images from the other direction that Unity does. It has features that would be like, you couldn't even, like, literally to get our players, our 2D characters interacting and being able to, like, layer with each other correctly, they had to, one of their engineers had to write this really long script. Because there was one feature, it looked like someone took Unity and tried to make an engine out of it, because they kept like leaving off these tick boxes, and this tick box, if you could have just ticked it, it would have been fine. But because you couldn't, they had to write this long thing. And literally when we got back into Unity after PlayStation Mobile, mm-hmm. you ticked that box and it was fine. So it was like, oh. And then so eventually 14, we had been working on it for a while and we were really trying to get it out on PlayStation Mobile, but I realized that I kind of felt like PlayStation Mobile isn't going to be around very long, much longer, and we were working to finish it on PlayStation Mobile, but we also needed like the future to think about that, so we planned for a Kickstarter, and I felt like that was basically like the only way I could keep going. And so 2014 was great because our second Kickstarter succeeded. So now we had money to keep working. But it was a terrible year in general because the first Kickstarter failed to fund, which meant it was like months of my time. Granted, those months went towards the second one, too, but it was just like 2.5 weeks. But I actually launched it 2.5 weeks after the first one failed to fund. And getting a successful Kickstarter sent me into money overdrive where I felt like every second was wasting money. So I basically didn't leave my computer that much.
Oh.
And I worked all the time and I didn't really realize that my marriage was falling apart, which it was falling apart for a lot of reasons, but I basically kept the game, I think, as like my distraction. And PlayStation Mobile also folded. And literally, I think around my birthday, somewhere around there, I got like an annulment thing that was like, basically, you're not getting the last bit and you don't bother trying to ship this thing because we're not doing it anymore.
Yeah,
we're not going to ask you for any of the other money back, but we're not going to give you this money that you were totally planning on when you also poorly budgeted for your Kickstarter. So it was like so it was just like getting punched. And then, you know, the end of the year, I got separated from my wife, and basically, you can look at my emails to Kickstarter backers. I stopped at a certain point in October because that was when we started talking about separation. And yeah, I just really started to try to find myself. And that kind of led into 2015 being a year of me trying to figure out myself. So like, that's kind of a lost year in dev. And we started porting the game to PlayStation from PlayStation Mobile to Unity. Things started going a lot better. 2016, after a bunch of uncertainty, we jump-started things again with the game. Also, in between all this, we kind of kept going, trying to get the game ready for publishers who would show interest, and then when you'd send them the game, would be like, this isn't really the thing we're looking for. And I'm like, sometimes they would cite like the graphics, and I'm like, you could see the graphics before I sent you. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could be like, yo, this isn't what I like. You know, that's like the problem with the publishing game is like, everyone's just really like cagey about like what they want. They'll be like, I want anything, and you'll send them something. They'll be like, not that. And you're like, you know, my game's good, man. It's like, so I mean, there was a lot of that over the years. But don't know, like, we really like the game, and, like, I always say I'm very stubborn, so we kept going. We almost canceled it numerous times. The thing is, the Kickstarter also puts you on the hook, and the thing is I'm not gonna, like, I had, like, occasionally, like, a person who put in, like the early bird amount, like, $10 to $12 or something, like, hassling me. Like, I don't think this is coming out, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, bro, my mom, who I'm trying to figure out, like, I'm about to put up a Kickstarter update that talks about this a little bit. Like, this is actually 6 years from when the Kickstarter funded. Like, my mom died last year. She put in $20. She didn't have $20 to put in. She asked me for money to buy toilet paper and stuff, like, literally several days after she put in $20, because she didn't have the money, but she wanted to see us succeed. And that was very emotional. I'm just like I care about my mom seeing me succeed, but I also care about like we had like the industry like support us on this Kickstarter. Like 28% of our funding came from Twitter. That is rare.
Yeah.
And that was like, it was like,
that's impressive.
Yeah, it was like, well, like, Ecky Collins, who does PR, mm-hmm. like, y'all know her. She, yep. Few other PR folks got together and they liked my game idea and they really wanted to do like see if they could help out a Kickstarter, so they helped out my Kickstarter by like really pounding the pavement and trying to get like people to talk about it. And they, so like a lot of outlets didn't write about it, but they tweeted about it like in the last few days coming up to it. They were just like, hey, check this out, and that helped. And like Ronix folks like tweeted about it, like John Drake and Pope and them, they were all still at Harmonix at the time. Like, again, the industry's changed so much.
Yeah, seriously.
And like, they were all at Harmonix, and like, they were running their Amplitude one, which started 2 days before mine ended, with mine still needed 50% funding. And they literally went on and said, hey, we're going to be doing this for the next 18 days. You should look at this Kickstarter for the next 18 hours. And they were like people in the industry just went hard for us. Like, just friends that I had met literally that year were like, this guy is smart, he's gonna make something cool, please back this. And that's how we got back the second time. Like, literally, it was like I went into the first Kickstarter being super quiet and being like, can't tell anybody about this because someone's gonna do something or something, I don't know, I didn't know what I was doing. And then I went to GDC, everyone was like, so what are you gonna do? Like, and I'm like, I'm gonna do it again. because, and I'm like, well, I'm going to be at PAX with the Indie Mega Booth, and Kickstarter actually gave me days in their room. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was like, well, I'll be at PAX East ready to like show the game. So I'm like, I'll get it started again right before PAX East, and hopefully, you know, the people who had already backed it before would come in, so we'd have a larger amount sitting there when people, so we could talk to people about that. And I think that helped a lot.
Sure.
Yeah. That. But again, like 50%. Funded in the last 3 days of the thing, because I think a large amount because of everyone's like help on Kickstarter. My mom also on Twitter, and my mom, and some of the money came from my mom literally going to like garden people, like her community garden, being like, you know, my son from I had been a member of the garden since I was like five, so like hey, can you help out? And like, she like bugged family members, people that she didn't really talk to that much, and you know, so people got in on that. And just like, again, like Eve Lang, like head of Iron Galaxy, mm-hmm. like he backed at like a G. So did Alex Rogopoulos, head of Harmonix. Like, these people, like, I didn't even know Alex Rogopoulos at all, and he would just back Kickstarters that looked interesting to him at good amounts. And it was like, you know, bless you for that, because like anytime that happened, like, I just freaked out. I was like, who the hell is this person? Never met him before, but thank you so much,
man. This is that's a really heartwarming story. Like, that's, I love to hear stories about the industry coming together to help developers who are up and coming, you know, get that leg up, that mm-hmm. you know,
and really cool ideas.
Yeah, seriously, absolutely. Want to land on one final question, and just ask, you know, you have been through AAA. You have been through the long development of an indie game that you've just released. If there is a piece of advice that you could give to other developers to keep them motivated, to keep them going like you have, what would that be?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like it's hard, because that I always say is build something that matters, mm-hmm. that's like cool and that matters. Like, gonna make something that, you know, excites people for like acting with it. You're gonna be like, it's gotta be a hardcore game or whatever. But you know, like, you know, take advantage of the fact that you're making a video game, but yeah, like build something with that's like a piece of the culture. I think that's made because like I think I made a lot of people go through like or game worship where they're like, I want to make a game like that. And you see a lot of business focused like games that show up, right? Like stuff that's like, I'm going to be top 10 on the App Store. And I hate all that stuff. Like, it's fine that it exists, but like, you know, the fact that 2048 exists is like the worst thing on the planet, because that's like, it's interesting because it's a cultural milestone in the world, because more people maybe know about 2048 than threes.
Yep. I hear you.
I sort of like 2048 and the other one more because like I think threes is like nauseatingly cute. Like I know Asher and I'm like, I've seen his pillows at his house of all that stuff. And there's a certain element that I actually like the fact that people could reskin 2048. So maybe that's not the best thing, but that game is like totally just stole from another game and people know about it. And I don't like that. Asher at least did something new and unique. And, you know, even if I didn't agree with the aesthetic choice, like, I think that was cool. Like, that was, like, a thing that people would be like, oh, I have a pillow of that. Like, that's something that I love.
Just real quick, in case our listeners don't know. So, Threes is a puzzle game. It's a mobile puzzle game. It was the only snappable game on Xbox One while you could still snap apps in that operating system. And it was mercilessly cloned, 2048. There are people who have accused Threes of being a clone of 2048, which is the most mind-boggling, infuriating thing, because
it's upsetting
because 2048 is the clone of Threes, and as we've talked about on this show before, you can't copyright or protect in any way a game mechanic.
Nope.
You can protect art, you can protect sound, you can protect a name,
mm-hmm.
but you can't protect the gameplay itself. So cloning, especially in the mobile sphere, is a rampant problem. And a topic we should probably dive into at some point, like as a topic for the show.
That's interesting.
But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to give that context listeners.
That makes 100% sense because, yeah, I'm way too into it. Like, I know everything about what's going on half the time. So it's like, you know, like all the stories and it's just, so I'm just like, make something cultural. Like, I think the thing is, we wanted to make a game that was supposed to be like the best beat 'em up once upon a time. And but it ended up being like more influenced by like, you know, and there was like the small twinge of like me wanting to make a game about what it's like to have massive anxiety living in a like urban wasteland in the 90s or in the 80s even, like, and being someone who's like different, who gets picked on and gets talked to weirdly by cops and by other people because I'm different. And because, like, you know, being a biracial kid with a white mom and having like people just yelling at you from all corners being like, why is this kid like darker with like curly hair with you, like, you know, just all of that is like embedded inside me, and that is in the game. Like, and like being stuff like Get Out, like the game taking so long to come out, like I saw Get Out, I saw Sorry to Bother You, these amazing movies that dealt with like people's internal fears and struggles within a system that's oppressive towards them, and that came out through the game, like over time when I started to feel a lot more comfortable with that. And then also, as I really just my whole life, I kind of grew up as an amalgam of a lot of things, and I really started to dive into like hip-hop and culture surrounding hip-hop and going into like art hip-hop and all that stuff. And like, that's super inspired it, because, like, you know, I have Open Mike Eagle doing a song for my game, and that's, like, literally, like, one of the, if I would have told 14-year-old me, they would have been like, a rap song about your game? Whatever. Like, adult me's like, man, this is a fucking piece of culture. Like, but, like, you know, and, like, no matter what my game does or doesn't do, I think it does the things that I wanted to do right. It's the game about, like, play that's I engage with that also has stuff like anxiety. It has microaggression humor. I see people that like know this humor, like know what it's like to live in a city, like they react to it very strongly. And then other people who are like, man, I want to play a game that like Open Mike Eagle did a song for and stuff. Like, so it's like, you know, getting to bring in people from a lot of different cultures, even if it's not like that's not going to do the numbers of like a clone, a mobile clone of something, like how, you know, speaking of clones, Candy Crush Saga stole from another game and mm-hmm. they try to put that game out of business.
Being oh, like, no. I remember that story. That's a doozy.
Yep, that one was rough.
Like, that, like, at the same time, though, it's like, you know, it's just a game about like shiny colored fruit. Right, like Candy Crush Saga is weirdly the bigger cultural thing, because I literally see people, but you know, so is Two Dots. So it's like Two Dots was a thing that was done on a lot smaller of a level, and I see people in the city on the train all over playing that game. And so, you know, you don't have to, like, that game definitely has like emotional attachment. The music's important. I talked to Open Mike Eagle about it. That's actually how we started to bond, was because like I'm like, I know the people who work at Dots. And so, you know, I just, like, if you're like, is my game not selling well, and you look at your game and it's also not like a cultural like touchstone, like it doesn't say anything about you, it just is like, that was my student project and we decided to finish it, or just decided to take these things from these other games and make like the hot newness and we didn't to capitalize on it, like, just like, yeah, fine. You made something that people didn't want, and that's cool. But if you make something that means a lot to you because it says a lot about you and it still doesn't do well, just know that that happens to musicians all the time. Like, that's poetry. That's other art forms, right? That's fine art. Like, you can't break through in every industry. And but at least you have something that you're proud of that says something about you and your team, as opposed to being like, we made this generic 3D platformer that we thought the quote unquote gamers would like, and they didn't. So now we're out of business. Rather, you know, you'd be a lot more proud being like, I went out of business making something that I cared about.
Yeah. Cool.
Sorry for the long.
No, this is great. And we are so grateful that you took the time to join us, especially knowing how busy your schedule is with the new baby.
Yeah.
The cute baby. He's
great. Adorable, adorable child. So yeah, this wraps up another episode of Virtual Economy. This was episode 20. Technically our 21st episode, because of the 0th episode.
We continue to be stupid.
We continue to be plagued by our hilarious choice to have an episode 0. Anywho, as a reminder, we love indies here at Virtual Economy. If you are an indie and you have a new game, an in-development game that you'd like to share, please reach out to us via DM at Virtual Econcast on Twitter, or via email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
We got through it.
We did. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow us on Twitter, as you might have guessed by the last thing I said, at Virtual Econcast. And I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow.
Sean, where can people find you online?
I am at A New Challenger, NU Challenger, because the NEW was taken when I tried to do that, by Anthony Carboni.
I didn't know Carboni.
I was like who's this guy? And it's funny because like just later I'm just like, one day I was like, oh, you're the reason why I don't have the right spelling. I was just doing margaritas in like a bar in like San Francisco or something. And then at beatdown_city is where the game is,
and it is out now and people can go purchase it. Or if they don't have the cash right now, they can go wishlist it.
It's on Steam. It's on itch.io. And it is on the Switch in the Americas. We're working on trying to get it out in Europe, but we're trying to localize in some languages before we do that.
Awesome. All right.
Okay, cool. And if this is your first episode sitting with us at Virtual Economy, you can actually subscribe to our RSS feed. We are virtualeconomy.libsyn, that's libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on all major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, Podcast Addict. We're everywhere. You can't escape us. But the best thing that you can do for us is subscribe, because it tells the algorithm gods that more than our mom likes us.
I like you. Moms. And moms. I am not your mom.
No, you are not my mom. That's probably a good thing.
Yes.
Because yikes.
Yes.
I like my mother, but yikes.
This
took a turn.
Episode
this took
weirdness.
A turn.
Yeah, let's see. We'll gloss right over that. And if you have questions for us, but not about that, you can DM us at VirtualEconCast or send us an email at podcast@fsquared.biz.
Also, speaking of F-Squared.
Speaking of F-Squared, we launched a consulting business. You can find out more about F-Squared at fsquared.biz. That's fsquared.biz. I did it.
You did it. I wouldn't have been able to. I'm too tired.
Oh, I didn't put the dash in there. That's the important part. Yeah, so we're doing, we're here to help developers, publishers. Again, we are not giving up on doing our pro bono work for small developers. Please do continue to reach out with us. We do have bandwidth to take on some of that work as well. And we will be back soon, later this week, with our new show. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you soon.